The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Suffering and the End of Suffering, taught by Bridget Rollins and John Yaffe. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, Bridget co-leads the St. Louis Insight Meditation Group, teaches classes, and leads retreats. John Yaffe began practicing insight meditation in 1999 and has been co-leader of St. Louis Insight Meditation Group since 2006. He has served on the board of directors of Mid-America Dharma since 2005 and currently serves as its president. More information about Bridget and John can be found at www.dharmastl.org.
So we come to our reflection on the third noble truth. And there's a task that goes along with each of the noble truths. So the task for the first noble truth is that suffering is to be understood. The task with the second is craving is to be abandoned. The task with the third is cessation of suffering is to be realized, made real. And the fourth is the Noble Eightfold Path is to be cultivated. This is how the Buddha describes the third noble truth. He says, "Now this is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha." And just calling to mind how John explained all the various facets of dukkha. So the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. The craving that is to be abandoned in the second noble truth. The Buddha described craving as a burning, and he said, "All is burning. And what is the all that is burning? The eye is burning. Forms that the eye sees is burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. Also, whatever is felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that arises with eye contact for its indispensable condition, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hate, and the fire of delusion." And then he takes that little formula and applies it to each of the senses. So applying it to the nose and contact with fragrances, the ear, contact with sounds, the tongue, contact with taste, the body in contact with physical sensation, the mind in contact with mental formations. When you think of the word desire, you might associate it with warmth or with heat. So, you know, we might have a lukewarm desire for something, and the heat isn't very strong. We also talk about having a burning desire. Have you ever had a burning desire for something? Fire consumes. So it consumes whatever's feeding it. And sometimes we talk of being consumed with desire. So just tuning into your own experience when you're craving, is there some heat to that? If you stop and think the physics of heat, molecules are vibrating at a very fast rate. And when there's a craving, do you feel that jitter, that buzz, that movement in the body? And we all know what that feels like. It's not really very pleasant to suffer, is it? And, you know, we're hardwired to try to find a way out of suffering. Our nervous system is always trying to find that safe place, always trying to find calm, homeostasis. The body's always looking for homeostasis. And so we're always looking for a cooling of that fire, aren't we? And interesting enough, the word that the Buddha has used in certain cases for this cessation is the word nibbana. And it's actually an everyday word, everyday household word from his time. And it just means to cool. So, you know, a mom might tell her child, let that rice get a little nibbana before you eat it so you don't burn your mouth. So nibbana, which we understand within the context of the teachings as this remainderless fading and cessation of suffering, is a cooling of the fires of craving. And we can understand this cessation of suffering described in the Third Noble Truth at two levels. So in the Third Noble Truth, in one sense, the Buddha is pointing to exactly what he says, the remainderless fading, that place where no defilements remain, that there's no possibility of the fuel that feeds suffering arising. It's been eradicated. And to think about that, to contemplate that, to think about the possibility of living in that way can create a wholesome desire in us, a wholesome desire. It can inspire our practice. You know, yeah, that's what I want. I'll tell you, that's what got me onto the Buddhist path. I'm a comfort addict and a greed type. You tell me that I'm going to have an end of suffering, and you got me. Buddha's a great salesman, huh? So the poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion are completely uprooted, never to come back again. And this is what we say is nibbana. Joseph Goldstein says, at this time, there are no cravings or yearnings, even for the next breath or next moment of experience. There's not the slightest impulse toward either becoming or not becoming. And just notice, we're still right in the middle of life. So we're still breathing. We're still experiencing moment after moment of this life. It's not like nirvana, the cessation of all suffering, that now somehow we're on some plane that has nothing to do with day-to-day living. But we've come into a relationship with life on a moment-by-moment basis that is without the roots of suffering. There's no cravings or yearnings, even for the next breath or the next moment of experience. There's not the slightest impulse towards either becoming, I want the next moment to become this, I want me to become this in the next moment, or not becoming, I don't want this to happen in the next moment. You know, I don't want to be this way in the next moment. That's all taken away. Another word that we use for this final cessation of craving is enlightenment. So how many of you want to become enlightened? Probably everyone here. Enlightenment, so light, the light of wisdom, comes to perfection at this point and completely drives out the darkness of ignorance. which is the root of all suffering. You know, the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, the only reason we get caught in those is because of a root ignorance about the way things are, about the Dhamma, about what does cause suffering, what brings suffering to an end. You know, the knowledge that it is possible to wake up, that's another word for enlightenment, waking up, the Buddha. Buddha, it just means one who is awake, one who is so awake that, you know, nothing gets past us. Nothing got past the Buddha in terms of what would cause suffering in life. And the knowledge that it's possible can inspire us to stay on the path, keep doing, keep cultivating all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I'll talk about that at the very end as we leave, just briefly. It's very inspiring to me to know that the Buddha was a human being, not some, you know, God or deity or something other than me, had exactly the same experiences as me. And that the Buddha and countless other human beings just like him have come to the cooling of all those conditions that lead to the burning of suffering. That it is possible. You know, the Buddha said, if it wasn't possible, I wouldn't teach you. So, the desire for liberation from suffering is a wholesome desire. However, within that desire can be a danger. One of our teachers and mentor, Matt Flickstein, I remember he said, one day I said to my teacher, Bhante Gunaratana, Bhanteji, the desire for enlightenment is an impediment to enlightenment. And Bhante replied, Matt, don't say that. Don't say that. And he said a second time, Bhante, the desire for enlightenment is an impediment to enlightenment. And he said, don't go around teaching that. People are going to get confused and discouraged. And a third time, he said, Bhante, I've discovered the desire for enlightenment is an impediment to enlightenment. And Bhanteji said, yes, Matthew, it is. There's something about this three times. There is a wholesome desire for enlightenment. There is also an unwholesome desire. If we become attached to the idea of enlightenment, if we form a concept in our minds of what it feels like, you know, what it would be like to be enlightened, and then we become attached to getting to that thing, and we keep measuring where we are by what we think enlightenment is, which, quite frankly, I would say probably most of us, you know, that it will be a state in which there's only pleasurable experience. Anybody think of enlightenment in those terms? Anybody willing to admit that you think of enlightenment in those terms? I do. Sometimes, you know, I have to check myself. Is my desire for enlightenment, or is my desire just for endless pleasure? You know, do I actually want to be released from the cycle of samsara, the birth and rebirth? Or do I want to get reborn in a deva realm where everything is pleasurable and there's, you know, nothing that's unpleasurable? You can eat powdered sugar donuts all day and you don't gain weight. And you don't get sick of them. The desire for enlightenment can be an impediment to enlightenment if we continually are conceiving of ourselves or conceiving a self that's enlightened. So it's like it's the craving for becoming. I want to become an enlightened being. I want to become enlightened. That's what we call conceit. That's not pride, you know. Conceit here is conceiving a self. And so, and quite frankly, the identification of oneself as enlightened, any identification with self creates suffering, but that identification or that conceiving of oneself as being enlightened is one of the last defilements to go. That sense of self, that's the last thing we let go of as we progress through stages of enlightenment. So I was thinking about an example of this, and I thought about the desire of getting to Chicago, which can be a very wholesome desire. You know, I might want to go up for a retreat there or something more mundane. You know, I like riding on the train. Well, no, okay, we can't do train in this example. But, you know, I want to go up and see the Museum of Natural History. I love going through the dinosaur exhibit. So I have a desire to go to Chicago. Now, if I stay in my apartment and I constantly dream of going to Chicago, and I lament the fact that I am not yet there in Chicago, and I just keep fantasizing about being in Chicago, and I get more and more angry that I'm not in Chicago, but I never take a single step to get to Chicago. You know, I have a desire. So I might dream all I want to about enlightenment and, you know, fantasize about, oh, I'll do this and that. But if I'm not actually practicing the path, I'm not going to get to Chicago. Or I might get a roadmap. You know, this is a skillful step if I wanted to get to Chicago. And I'll see how to get to Chicago. So I see, okay, I take this route, all right. But as I'm driving, I just keep going back and looking at the dot where Chicago, and with the word Chicago next to it. And, oh, I'm not there. Oh, and I'm so focused on the end of the journey, so focused on Chicago and all the things I'm fantasizing about what Chicago is and how wonderful it would be to be there, that I'm missing exits that I need to take, or I'm taking exits that take me somewhere else, or I'm crashing into cars, or I'm falling off the road. So again, the original desire to get to Chicago is a very wholesome desire, but if I'm attached, to that outcome and I keep focusing in a way that is clinging to being in Chicago already, then I'm not going to get there. Because what it takes to get to Chicago is to pay attention moment by moment to where I am on the road so that I am avoiding collisions, getting around the construction, noticing that exit is not going to take me towards Chicago, and this exit will take me towards Chicago. So we can see how, you know, if I'm attached to being in Chicago now when I haven't even made it to Bloomington, that's going to cause suffering. And it's not going to be helpful for my journey. So my desire to be in Chicago becomes an impediment to getting to Chicago. And, you know, we can translate this into our desire for freedom, our desire for liberation. You know, wouldn't you just like to have it right now? And I don't know, I think maybe there are some enlightened beings out there, you could get a transmission. Maybe we could find them and they could just ding. They probably have a little bell clapper and they tap you on the head with it and ding. So if we are attached to enlightenment, and usually it's more attachment to our concept of enlightenment, our concept of nirvana, and we keep measuring where we are by that, not in terms of just to kind of see, oh, what's the next step I need to make, but we keep measuring and finding ourselves lacking. You know, well, I'm not there yet. Oh, you know, okay, I've been practicing for a week now. I'm not there yet. You know, I've been practicing for 5 months now. I'm not there yet. It's been a year. It's been 2 years. It's been 10 years. It's been 20 years. It's been my 3,999,044 lifetime, and I'm not there yet. We can see that there would be the possibility of discouragement. Do you ever experience discouragement with this? Yeah. So maybe not everybody does, but probably everybody in this room at some point has experienced some little discouragement of why aren't I farther along? You know, here I am at Staunton. Why aren't I at Litchfield? So there's the danger of discouragement that comes from clinging to enlightenment, which is kind of desire gone awry. And again, if we keep telling ourselves we should be in Chicago when we are only passing Springfield, if our sight is on that without paying attention to what's happening in the present moment, then many unforeseen conditions can delay our arrival. We only get to our destination if we're present to meet and overcome all of those challenges to getting to where we want to go, to where we need to go. You know, and even with perfect road conditions, it still takes time to get to Chicago. We haven't found the transporter that'll beam us there yet. And so, you know, there is a natural organic unfolding of this coming to the cessation of suffering. And if we can just love and accept that, if we can just open ourselves to that, not be alarmed by the fact that we haven't gotten farther than we are, and just keep coming back and doing whatever we can in this moment to the best of our knowledge that will lead us one more step closer to, as we might say, Enlightenment City. So the way to avoid discouragement is to appreciate all the little moments of arrival along the road to enlightenment, to love the journey itself. And letting go of the destination doesn't mean that we'll lose our way. You know, we still have a sense of where we're going. But if we take, I think the Tibetans said, if you take care of the moments, the future takes care of itself. So we don't have to keep fixated about where we're not. We just come back and deal with where we are. So that brings us to another way of understanding enlightenment, which is that there are moments where we do come to the cessation of suffering. And Ajahn Buddhadasa had a little pamphlet. It was called Nibbana for Everyone. He kind of took this lofty practice that was relegated to monks and nuns, and he kind of translated it into contemporary life for householders. So he says, Nibbana shouldn't be understood as the province of arhants, fully realized beings. We all have little tastes of it. Nibbana is a natural condition. It's the cool state of mind without any defilements. Anyone can see that if defilements are with us all day and night, every second without ceasing, who could ever stand them? Under such conditions, living things must either die or become insane and finally die. Let us consider well the fact that one survives because there are periods when the fires of defilement are not burning. And this is just a part of life. Periodical nibbana, momentary nibbana, keeps all of us alive and well without making any exceptions. We survive because of the nourishment from this kind of nibbana. So what this points to is the value of mindfulness, that we're not just mindful of the defilements that come up. We're not just mindful of greed, hatred, delusion. We do want to be very clear and know that, but we also want to pay attention long enough to notice when that ends. Because there's a little moment of the cessation of suffering. And we want to get a taste for that. Getting little tastes of that can give us encouragement. It can fuel us. It's like getting a drink of water. The nibbana is cooling. So it's like you take a drink of water and the burning of the suffering is relieved for a few moments. And if we get a taste of that, that can give us encouragement to hang in there. Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Guy Armstrong talks about several avenues for non-clinging. Okay, so, you know, how do you get to this non-clinging? And he said, one thing, just wait for your clinging to pass. If you wait long enough without acting or reacting, that craving will pass and you'll have this moment of this moment of the coolness of the passing. And then develop greater skill at releasing voluntarily. So we don't have time to, that could be a whole other talk. How do you let go? And really all you need to do is hold that question in your mind. How do I let go? And then find out for yourself. What does letting go mean for you? And play with it. I find it very encouraging. Ajahn Chah said 70 to 80% of spiritual life is knowing you're clinging and not being able to let go. So we got 20 to 30% of being able to let go. But just knowing that we're clinging, knowing that we're not letting go, that's wisdom. You know, at least we're aware of that. Otherwise, we're just on autopilot and we're clinging to everything. We're just bouncing off out of our reactivity. As I said before, being aware of the moments in which you do let go and experience that cessation of suffering, and just understanding the mind is not stupid. If we give it good, clean data so it really sees, oh, this is suffering. Oh, this is the cessation. This is letting go of suffering. Gradually, it's going to turn and incline towards the non-suffering. So how do we create conditions that lead to the cessation of suffering? If I look at the other three noble truths, I think there is a formula there, a remedy there. So I create the conditions that will lead by understanding dukkha, first noble truth, by abandoning the clinging, second noble truth, by cultivating the noble eightfold path, fourth noble truth. The secret seems to lie in knowing what we need to let go of and how to let it go. And the Buddha has given us a path that will show us that, that will lead to deeper and deeper and clearer knowledge of the causes of our suffering and show us the way to let go of it, to let go of those causes and conditions, to withdraw the fuel that creates the fire of craving. So if we just keep patiently putting one foot in front of the other on this path, eventually we will come to the remainderless fading and cessation of suffering. Eventually we will come to that remainderless fading and cessation of suffering. And I just like to close this with a poem by a yoga teacher, Dana Falls. And I made copies of it. It's on the table there for you. It's called Let It Go. So just settling for a moment and opening the mind, the heart, the ears, just to receive these words. Let them be like rain that falls on the ground and gently sinks into the ground of your heart. Let go of the ways you thought life would unfold, the holding of plans or dreams or expectations. Let it all go. Save your strength to swim with the tide. The choice to fight what is here before you now will only result in struggle, fear, and desperate attempts to flee from the very energy you long for. Let go. Let it all go and flow with the grace that washes through your days, whether you receive it gently or with all your quills raised to defend against invaders. Take this on faith. The mind may never find the explanations that it seeks, but you will move forward nonetheless. Let go, and the wave's crest will carry you to unknown shores, beyond your wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go and find the place of rest and peace and certain transformation. And I might add the transformation that is Nibbana, that is enlightenment. Let go, and the wave's crest will carry you to unknown shores, beyond your wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go and find the place of rest and peace and certain transformation. So let's continue on this Noble Eightfold Path by bringing moment by moment awareness, by bringing the practice of mindfulness to the activities of your body as you engage in eating lunch and whatever else you decide to do with the time, this personal time. And we will meet back here at 1 o'clock.